I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in February, President Trump signed an executive order to roll back the clean water rules that had been enacted by President Obama back in 2015.
EPA's so-called Waters of the United States rule is one of the worst examples of federal regulation, and it has truly run amok and is one of the rules most strongly opposed by farmers, ranchers, and agricultural workers all across our land. It's prohibiting them from being allowed to do what they're supposed to be doing. It's been a disaster. It's a horrible, horrible rule. Has sort of a nice name, but everything else is bad. I've been hearing about it for years and years. I didn't know I'd necessarily be in this position to do something about it, but we've been hearing about it for years. With today's executive order, I'm directing the EPA to take action, paving the way for the elimination of this very destructive and horrible rule. So I want to thank everybody for being here, and I will sign wherever I'm supposed to sign. There we are. Thank you very much.
This is just one of several campaign promises President Trump made to get rid of environmental regulations. Well, our guest Sandra Postel knows fresh water. She's director of the Global Water Policy Project. She served as a freshwater fellow at the National Geographic Society and is co-creator of Change the Course. This is a freshwater initiative that has restored billions of gallons of water to depleted rivers and wetlands in North America. And she joins us on Radio Times to talk about the threats to fresh water and conservation efforts to improve water quality and supply. Some facts to set the stage for our discussion. 2.5% of the Earth's water is fresh water, and two-thirds of that water is frozen in glaciers and in ice caps. It takes about 2,000 gallons a day to maintain the typical American lifestyle. It also takes 700 gallons of water to make a cotton shirt. And I got all that information from our guest, Sandra Postel. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's hear what you have to say about the Waters of the United States rule. Now, my understanding is that it's actually been sort of caught up in the court system and never actually implemented. But what do we need to know about this?
Well, I actually happened to participate with other scientists in preparing an amicus brief for the Supreme Court cases that led to that rule. And the point we tried to make at that time was water is connected. All water is connected. So if you're concerned about only about navigable waters, you really have to be concerned about the tributaries and the waters upstream that keep the quality and quantity of the navigable waters healthy and clean. And so it's that attempt to make it connected. Now, the implementation maybe needs to be thought through more thoroughly, but the idea is to really focus on, you know, the integrity of ecosystems in this country and how connected water is.
And is it the idea that looking at the Clean Water Act, that covers, I guess, sort of large bodies of water, whereas something like this covers these smaller streams and things that even come and go depending on the seasons?
Right. I mean, the Clean Water Act was from 1972, which did a miraculous job of really cleaning up our rivers and lakes. That's not to say we don't have a ways to go, as we're discovering. But also to put in perspective what's happened under the Trump administration, the budget agreement that Congress and the president agreed to this month was surprisingly okay in terms of water activities. And so we've seen, for example, the big regional initiatives around water, the Great Lakes Initiative, the Chesapeake Bay Initiative, they basically have not had their funding changed. The Long Island Sound Initiative and the Gulf of Mexico Initiative, where we have the problem of dead zones, those actually saw their funding doubled. And so right now it's not looking so terrible. And we'll see what happens down the line. But, you know, right now Congress has said business cares about clean water. The people care about clean water, and we need to keep it moving forward.
So should we not be nervous?
I think we should stay vigilant because we don't know what the next budgets will be like. And I think there'll continue to be a need to be, you know, proactive in keeping these programs moving forward.
You mentioned the EPA started in the early 1970s. You and I were talking about back in 1969, the Ohio Cuyahoga River caught fire. This was from pollution, right?
This was from pollution. This was in 1969. It was sort of soaked. The river was soaked with oil, and it literally caught fire. And I think it woke people up to the seriousness of pollution in our rivers and lakes, and it along with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which was alerting us to the problems of pesticides and chemicals. I think the Cuyahoga told us we need to pay attention here and start cleaning things up. And so the Clean Water Act came on the heels of that. The setting up of the EPA in 1970 came 1 year later. And I have to say, this was during the Republican administration of Richard M. Nixon. And so this was a very bipartisan issue that we need clean water. We need to control the pollution. So this partisanship over water is not historically the way we've gone about it.
But why do you think the EPA was such a target during the campaign?
I think it's the partisanship. And I think it's, you know, I view it as sort of going backwards. You know, we had this myth going on for a long time that it was environment versus economy. It's not that at all. A healthy environment supports a healthy economy. My work with Change the Course and National Geographic really showed how businesses care about healthy, flowing, clean rivers because it brings tourism dollars. It brings, you know, good employees to where businesses are located if they have outdoor recreational activities and healthy rivers. And so it's really part of a healthy economy, not in any way opposed to it.
How would you describe our drinking water? And we're not going to talk about lead pipes or anything like that, but the water that gets to our water systems, urban water systems. How would you describe the quality of that?
Well, generally, it's very high quality. In fact, it's regulated better than bottled water is regulated. They're regulated by different agencies. And so I have no trouble drinking tap water virtually anywhere I am. Occasionally, I'll find it doesn't taste so good because of the extra chlorine. But in terms of healthy water, it's usually very good. Now, the lead problem is serious.
Right.
There's a lot of aging pipes across the country. The Flint tragedy, really, is not an isolated case. I mean, it's a problem we have to look at and try to correct wherever these older pipes that included lead exist. But on the whole, we have very, very good clean water being delivered to our urban water systems.
And here's a really basic question. Where does our water come from, our drinking water come from?
Well, this is a good question, and it's amazing. You know, very few people know the source of their water. And that's, I think, a first step people can take to get engaged is where does that water come from that's coming out of my faucet every morning? And so really there are two sources, surface water or groundwater. And about half of the country gets its drinking water from underground. So those are called aquifers. The water is pulled up and delivered. The other half comes from rivers or lakes. And so keeping all those systems, you know, in adequate supply and clean is super important.
Do we have enough water in this country? I mean, I realize you might answer differently if you're talking to us from California a year ago. But when you see water distributed around the country, what do you see?
Well, the East certainly is much better watered than the West. In terms of population and water relationships, the East, you know, has a lot more supply per person.
We just get more rain?
Get more rain. You know, pretty much anywhere east of the 100th meridian, which runs down through, you know, part of Texas and up north, you know, east of there, farmers don't need to irrigate as much, you know, so not as much water needs to be used in agriculture. Rainfall usually does the trick. Often they'll have supplemental irrigation. Cities usually have adequate quantity, except in droughts. We've seen, you know, almost any major city in the East is going to occasionally be facing a drought and have to prepare for that and deal with it when it occurs. In the West, we have a more chronic problem of shortage, where we have more people and more agriculture that depends on irrigation. And so water shortage is a more chronic phenomenon, and we have to deal with it that way. When a drought hits, like California's had 4 years between 2012 and 2016, that's a serious, you know, serious issue. But the silver lining in all of this is that there's still a lot we can do to use water more efficiently, to conserve. We haven't begun to tap out those solutions. And agriculture in the West continues to be the biggest user of water. So if we save even a relatively small amount in agriculture, that frees up water to put back in rivers. It frees up water to supply cities in need. So I think there's a lot we can do through smarter management, you know, to help us get through this.
What about things like just leaky water taps, things like that, leaky pipes?
Leaky pipes, they're not a sexy issue, but they are often a very big problem. You know, back in the 80s when Boston was looking at having to expand its supply, This was in the 80s. They were looking at diverting water from the Connecticut River, which is the biggest river in New England, to help supply Boston. And the conservation community said, hey, wait a minute, we're trying to, you know, restore the salmon populations in the Connecticut. How about if we look more seriously at conservation? One of the things that worked well in Boston was fixing the old leaking pipes.
Really?
Yeah. So water use in greater Boston today is about 43% less than it was 50 years ago. Excuse me, at the peak.
At the peak.
So it's back now where it was 50 years ago. And that's a phenomenal success. This is a vibrant economy. There's been no adverse impact from that, but there's been no need to divert the Connecticut River. So it's a great example of how conservation can benefit the local community economy, but also help protect rivers at the same time.
Would that apply to homeowners as well, or people living in apartments, just making sure you don't have leaky pipes or leaky faucets?
Exactly. Fixing leaks. That was part of what Boston and other cities always do, is they encourage homeowners to install the most efficient fixtures, so toilets, faucets, and showerheads. Now, that said, in 1993, the U.S. passed water efficiency standards at the federal level. So very few people know about this. But as a result of that act, we're now saving 7 billion gallons of water a day across the country because we've built conservation into our homes and offices. And we have, you know, when I was a kid, it took about 6-7 gallons of water to flush the toilet, right? Now it takes 1.6 or less. So that's a big savings. And it means that we don't have to build another reservoir, divert another river, because we've saved that water. We're doing the same job, but with less water.
And are those the stickers that you might see on a washing machine or some kind of an appliance?
Yeah, well, that's another program that EPA has been running is called Water Sense. And, you know, it basically helps consumers pick dishwashers, faucets, toilets, you know, that conserve water. So it's a labeling program that it lets you as a consumer know if I choose this appliance or fixture, it's going to help me save water.
And does that program still exist? Was it on the
chopping
block?
It's been on the chopping block, but as far as I know, it still exists. I just wrote a blog about this. The Alliance for Water Efficiency has been leading a campaign to get people to write their congresspeople to make sure we keep this program going because it costs very, very little. But it has saved an enormous amount, not only of water, but energy when we save hot water, and money because homeowners have lower water bills if they're using less water. So it's the savings far outweigh the cost of this program, which is maybe $2 to $5 million a year, as I understand it. So
and it's just a fixing program. A label, right? I mean, it's not much more than that.
Well, it's making sure that the product meets the standards, the criteria for being part of that program, and then fixing a label and marketing it that way.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about water, fresh water, with our guest, Sandra Postel. She's director of the Global Water Policy Project. She also has served as a Freshwater Fellow of the National Geographic Society, co-creator of Change the Course. She's got a book coming out in the fall called Replenish, The Virtuous Cycle of Water and Prosperity. We're touching on some of those issues. You can join our conversation. You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we are not talking about lead pipes. I just want to put that out there, but there's lots of other water issues that we will be talking about. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sandra Postel about fresh water. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Is water too cheap? Do you think, should we pay more for the water that we use?
I would say in general, yes. Most households are not paying the full cost of water. And if you think about it, what you're paying for your cable bill, your phone, it's usually less, depending on where you live, but usually less. So I think pricing water more effectively, and it doesn't necessarily mean a higher bill, but sometimes pricing it more effectively. So in other words, what researchers have found is that very often it's the higher end water users that bump up the whole utility's water demand. And so if you can try to encourage people to use less at the very top, so usually they're at landscape watering.
I was just thinking,
if you can reduce that, then it reduces the need to build a new reservoir, build a bigger reservoir. And so pricing water, what they call a conservation rate structure. So the more you use, the higher you're paying. So it gives you an incentive to reduce that water use at the top. And that can sometimes be very effective. And it will rarely affect the people who are using a modest amount of water.
Oh, that's interesting. I see people watering either their lawns, or sometimes these are sort of large spaces, at noon with the sun shining, and you just know most of that water is just going to evaporate.
Right, and it that's all about incentives. You know, I think we learned in the 70s with energy to turn off the lights when we leave a room. Sometimes we forget, but we often remember, turn off the TV. Things that use energy, turn them off. Same idea, get smarter about when you irrigate, how much you irrigate, the kind of plants you have in your garden. Planting more native, climate-appropriate plants, especially in the West, is really crucial. You don't want bluegrass lawn, you know, where I live in New Mexico. You want climate-adaptive, water-thrifty, drought-tolerant plants.
What is the effect of climate change on fresh water? And I realize that's probably complicated and, again, depending on where people live. But overall,
it's a big question. And the thing to remember about climate change is that we're mostly going to experience climate change through the water cycle. Changes in precipitation. What happens as the climate warms is that the atmosphere expands, which means it can hold more water. And so that means you're having more evaporation and more precipitation. And so as a rule of thumb, dry areas will likely get drier, wet areas will likely get wetter. So we'll see more severe droughts, mm-hmm. more severe floods. We are probably seeing this already. And so that's going to change a lot of things. And we can't expect the past to be a good guide to the future anymore when it comes to water. We're already seeing places that have seen Hurricane Matthew last year, which hit North Carolina so badly. There were places that saw a 500-year flood twice in 17 years. That's really off the charts. And so, you know, how do we plan for that? And so I think one of the main points of my book is that we need to bring nature back into this equation, that we need to have nature help us control floods better. We can't rely on levees and reservoirs only anymore. Dams and levees aren't going to do the trick. So we need to bring floodplains back in. We need to bring wetlands back in. And they have multiple benefits for us. You know, they're going to store water. They're going to clean water. They're going to, when the drought comes, there'll be more water in the natural system to release gradually. So it'll help moderate all of these impacts. And nature does this pretty much for free if we give it a chance.
How does that work? How do you bring back a wetlands?
Well, you can construct a wetland. Cities do this to help them treat water. They give an extra sort of polishing to the treatment before it heads off into a river. So you can construct it. You can also allow them to come back naturally. So it's, you know, it's a combination. But wetlands are phenomenally important as a deliverer of what we call ecosystem services, you know, the benefits that we get from nature just by nature doing its thing. And so if we can allow that to happen more, we can rely less on infrastructure and more on nature to do some of these important things.
I'm curious about the impact of sea level rise on fresh water.
Sea level rise is potentially a game changer for a whole number of reasons. First of all, so many people live near the coast now, around the world. Big populations, biggest cities are along the coast. But where you have freshwater aquifers, underground water supplies that are along the coastal plain, what can happen is instead of the groundwater flowing out into the bay underground, the seawater can begin to invade. And that's going to become, it's already happening, but it's going to become worse as sea level rises. So you already see parts of Florida where this is a big, and the Carolinas where this is a big problem, where you have to now start to treat the salty water before you can turn it into drinking water, which of course gets very expensive, and that's going to become more and more, you know, of a problem.
As we see sea level rise, and it is measurable, I always think that that's one of the most obvious effects of climate change, the fact that there is measurable sea level rise.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, of all the consequences of climate change, that one we're pretty certain has been occurring faster than the climate scientists had expected. So we're going to see sea level rise impacts, I think, occurring sooner than we might have thought we would. Mm.
Let me get someone who called our – oh, I will get someone to call our text or comment line. A tweet from P. Edward, how about reclaiming flood water? I mean, are there things that can be done when there are these big floods to try to hold on to that water or somehow manage it better?
Well, that's a great question, and this is becoming a big new thing. We've always sort of considered storm water – the sort of flood water that happens during a big rain to be a nuisance, you know, just figure out a way to get rid of it. And now what we're discovering is this is actually potentially a great asset to us if we can manage it well. Right. And Philadelphia is one of the cities that's actually doing a lot with this. You know, they've got 1,000 projects trying to infiltrate rainwater into the ground rather letting it run off into the streets, which then pollutes the river. And so basically trying to, you know, use the cityscape as more like a sponge, you know, allow mm-hmm. it to absorb that water, hold it, recharge underground supplies, keep the river clean, release that water more gradually. So we're beginning to rethink urban design. We have a lot of, you know, impervious pavement, streets and roads and driveways and so on. Well, we're starting to think about putting in pervious pavement that allows water to seep through it. Swales alongside streets so that the rainwater gets captured and infiltrates rather than flooding the street. So this is happening, you know, in many cities around the country and the world. China is looking big time at this.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because it deals both with floods and droughts.
Green roofs?
Green roofs.
Is that part of it?
Absolutely. Chicago has something like 500 green roofs now, including on top of City Hall. So this is, it's a way to have urban gardens, but also capture rainwater, put it to use, keep the streets from flooding. So this kind of green, what we call green infrastructure, is becoming a big new part of urban design.
Well, let me get Elizabeth to join our conversation, and she called our comment line.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, calling from the media area. I'd like to ask your guest what she thinks of the effects of fracking on groundwater and how that is going to look down the line with all the chemicals that's pouring into our water systems.
And that's especially important in Pennsylvania with the Marcellus Shale.
Yes, it is. You know, I think we have to be very vigilant about fracking. And of course, once you contaminate groundwater, it's very hard to clean it up. It's not like a river where it's flowing. I mean, we don't want to contaminate anything, but a river flows and cleanses itself more quickly than groundwater does. So once you contaminate groundwater, it's hard to clean up and expensive to clean up. Now, that said, I think the evidence that we've done a lot of that so far is not that strong. We have to be vigilant, but at least the looking that the EPA has done, to my knowledge, hasn't found a lot of places, with the exception of methane contamination. But in terms of the contamination that might come from the fracking chemicals, we've seen some of it, I think, but not as much as we might think. But we have to regulate this. This can't be sort of the Wild West. We need to regulate fracking. You know, I have to say,
we need to know the chemicals that are used in fracking.
We should be able to know the chemicals that are used and be able to monitor them. We should have baseline data so that when we do monitor, we can see have things changed. I mean, this is important drinking water, and it's often in people's backyards. That said, I want to say fracking has been one of the reasons our carbon emissions have gone down. We're relying less on coal and oil, more on natural gas. So in some sense, it's helped us meet some of our, you know, climate reduction, our carbon reduction goals. And so it's not all negative in my view. And it's also reduced our dependence on Middle East oil, which has some geopolitical benefits. So it's not so black and white to me.
What do you make of desalination, the idea of processing salt water so that we get fresh water? Is that an effective way to think about at least expanding the supply of water?
So desalination is a, you know, very viable technology. We've been doing it for quite a while. You can either distill the salt water and leave the fresh water behind, or more commonly, you use reverse osmosis, which is a membrane system where you push the salt water through the membrane and get the fresh water out the other side. Mm. The problem with desal is that it's quite expensive and it's quite energy intensive. So to me, it's not the most elegant solution to our water problems if we're concerned about climate change to have more energy required to produce our drinking water. So I think, again, we have a tendency to solve our water problems by looking for the next new supply. And desalination is often seen as that silver bullet. What we forget to do most commonly is think about, well, how do we use the water we have?
Yeah.
more wisely. And most of the time, conservation, recycling, reuse are far cheaper than desalination.
And that's Sandra Postel. She knows her fresh water. She's director of the Global Water Policy Project, has served as a freshwater fellow at the National Geographic Society, co-creator of Change the Course. And we are talking about the various threats to fresh water and also conservation efforts to improve water quality and water supply. We got people calling our comment line. You can also text it 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email. I see them coming in. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How does the U.S. compare to the rest of the world? And again, one of these global questions when it comes to supply and quality of water. I was reading that two-thirds of the world face water shortages. Does that seem about right to you?
Yeah, it depends how you define water shortages. But in general, the U.S. is in pretty good shape. But, of course, we've got a big divide between East and West. And so the West has a whole different water management challenge, in a sense, than the East does, although we're starting to see similarities in parts of the East that are running short of water and that have competition between ag and urban areas. But in general, we're a pretty water-wealthy country. And you know, we're very lucky to have abundant rainfall in the heartland of our country, where we have some fabulous, you know, beautiful agricultural land. So I think we're very blessed when it comes to water, but we do have to, you know, manage it wisely in terms of quality and quantity. You look at a country like China, they have 20% of the world's people, but only 8% of the fresh water. And they've got also a divide in their case between south and north, more water in the south than in the north. So our challenges are in some ways less dire than India, China, that have more serious shortage issues. But I think we've all got our challenges to pay attention to.
Can you imagine water wars? I mean, wars or conflicts fighting over water supply?
You know, what I imagine more is the sort of cycle of social disruption and political upheaval that comes from shortage of water that leads to rising food prices, that leads to riots, that leads to social disruption. We've seen this, you know, some attribute the Arab Spring in North Africa that happened a few years ago, and we're continuing to see the manifestations of attributable to that sort of scenario. The Pentagon refers to climate change as a quote-unquote threat multiplier because it understands this kind of cascading of effects, that if you have a shortage of water, you have food problems, rising food prices, and then you get, you know, basically civil unrest that can lead to political change. And that scenario can happen in more and more places as you have, you know, these events unfold this way.
Let me get another caller to join our conversation. Jim from Wilmington.
Guest opinion that the resistance to the EPA is based solely in politics. She should understand it's based in the viewed overreach of the EPA beyond its charter and beyond its legality. That is the issue. Agree or not, that's the issue. It's not just politics, and she should understand that, and it would be helpful if she could address that.
The question of overreach in the EPA, and I certainly have heard this criticism.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I think there's a broader attack, though, on the environmental goals that have been set for the country than just the overreach issue. You know, and I think on balance, the EPA has done a remarkably helpful job in cleaning up our air and water. There's no question that our human health, the health of our rivers, the health of our communities, it's far better today than it was before the EPA came into existence. Now, we can argue, you know, what's overreach and what's not, and that might be a legitimate place for discussion about how involved we want the EPA in these issues. But on balance, we can say that the EPA has done a helpful job in terms of our human health and the health of our communities and our waters and airs. Yeah, water and air.
Waters and air. You mentioned business, and I know from your organization, Change the Course, that there is some collaboration with business saying that there are things that we agree on.
Oh, on the whole, business gets this.
Truly?
Yeah. I mean, not 100%, but absolutely. I mean, last year, the World Economic Forum, which meets in Davos, Switzerland every year, and brings together, you know, civic leaders, CEOs of many companies, government leaders, they declared that water crises was the biggest threat to society over the next decade. Mm-hmm. If you look at the, you know, Fortune 100 companies, you know, business risk around water is taken very, very seriously by 90% of them. And so it's figuring out what we do with that. But business sees that water security, without water security, you don't have a business. You don't have a community. You don't have recreation. So all of these things have come together, and businesses have to be forward-looking about this. And so Change the Course has been very fortunate to partner with now more than 30 companies from all different sectors of the economy that want to not only balance their own water footprint, but also help restore water to the natural world. And that's what Change the Course is about. It's a movement of water stewardship that brings the public and companies together to do that and works with conservation groups on the ground to make sure we can restore water to have healthy rivers and healthy wetlands again. And it's working. And businesses have surprised us in how creatively they want to engage in this. It's just been phenomenal.
Let me read an email from Doug who says, could you discuss what Germans do to conserve water? I understand they are one of the most conservation-conscious users of water among industrialized nations. Do you know, and is there collaboration with other countries?
I don't know the German situation in particular, but in general, the European countries in general have been quite efficient in their use of water. If you go to Stockholm, or I'm sure I haven't been in Germany in a while now, but the city, the fixtures tend to be efficient. They had dual flush toilets. They have more efficient fixtures and appliances. So I think in general they've been on the head of the curve on many of these issues.
Well, we are talking about fresh water quality and supply. Our guest again, Sandra Postel, director of the Global Water Policy Project. She's also co-creator of Change the Course that we were just talking about. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We also want to add another guest to our conversation, talking about the role of freshwater mussels. You heard it. Call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. While freshwater mussels play a vital role in the health of streams and rivers and creek beds through their filtering system, they also have some colorful, even hilarious names: monkey face, sheep nose, fat mucket, big toe, snuff box. Our guest, Abby Gosho-Landis, is a veterinarian. She's also a self-described freshwater mussel groupie. Her book, Immersion, is a celebration of these bivalves, the threats that they face, and also efforts to rebuild the population. And Abby, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's wonderful to be here.
Nice to have you here. So what has made you a freshwater mussel groupie? Let's start there.
I was lucky enough to be introduced to mussels when I was pregnant with our first child. I joined my husband, the biologist, to snorkel a creek in Alabama. And mussels offered me an opportunity to see the creek from the bottom up and gave me my Rivers 101 education and became quite an obsession for me to learn more.
Just because they're so unusual?
They're unusual. They're unexpected. They have fascinating life history strategies. They require a fish to host their larvae.
Well, in fact, let me pick up on that. Walk us through, if you could, the kind of life cycle then of a freshwater mussel.
Absolutely. So for them to reproduce, the males and females don't need to be close to each other. The male casts sperm into the water. The female takes it into her gills and broods her babies, her larvae, until a fish comes along. They have a parasitic life stage that requires particular fish host species, and to get the babies to the fish, the female has to attract a fish. Different mussel species have different strategies for doing this. One of the most spectacular is that part of their body resembles the bait or the favorite food of that fish, and so they evert it out of their shells and wave it in the current.
How sexy is that, right?
They are very sexy, actually.
Any fish? Will any fish do, or are they particular about the kind of fish they want to attract?
It depends on the mussel species. You have mussel species who really will only succeed on a single host fish species, and so they have adapted to coexist. Mm-hmm. You have mussels that are generalists and can succeed on more than one species.
How long does a mussel live?
Mussels can live for decades, even up to hundreds of years. There are many mussels out there who are older than I am.
Really? And you're not that, well, you're not that old. You're not as old as Sandra and I. I'll just put it that way. Help us understand the filtering system. And then, Sandra, I want to get you back in on the conversation. How does that work? And how would that compare to a water treatment facility, if it's possible to compare and contrast?
Good question. Mussels are filter feeders, and so they draw water from the creek or river into their bodies through their siphons. They have these little openings. One takes the water in and filters it through their gills, and each mussel species has slightly different gills, and so they select slightly different particles. They process it. Some they consume, some they get rid of, and then they exhale through their other siphon. Basically, and this is still under study, is what exactly do they take out, what do they store down into the creek bottom, and what do they recycle back in.
But they are a water filter system, right?
They are.
Let me get you back in on the conversation, Sandra. You were talking about the role of wetlands. Talk about mussels.
Well, Abby's written a great book, so I appreciate being on the show with Abby. Mussels are just a fantastic example of what we were talking about earlier about an ecosystem service. You know, this is a little organism that is helping us keep water clean. And, you know, I think up to, you know, a liter of water per hour that a mussel can filter. And so if you have a community of mussels in a stream or a river, it's like having a little water treatment plant. You know, it may reduce the cost of treating that drinking water downstream if you've got a healthy mussel population upstream. So it's another example of the benefits of keeping our rivers and streams and creeks flowing and healthy and of good quality so that you have this service going. Now, I happen to be maybe not as much of a groupie as Abby, but I'm pretty much a mussel. I've written blogs on mussels. One of our Change the Course projects, in fact, is in the Flint River Basin in southwestern Georgia, where we're working with partners there to try to encourage a kind of more efficient, smarter irrigation process that allows irrigators to pump less groundwater, which then helps keep more flow, in this case, in some of the tributaries like Spring Creek, to the Flint. And so it's a way to help mussels, help the river, and there's no harm to the irrigators if they can do this efficiently. So It's a way to try to just get smarter about how we use that water.
And Abby, you write that this part of the U.S., I guess the southeast part of the U.S., is a rich environment for mussels.
It is the global hotspot for mussel species diversity. It's like a tropical rainforest. It's one of the best kept secrets is that the southeastern U.S. has incredible aquatic life. And due to some of the...
I was going to say, why? Do we know why?
It is due to some of the geologic variability and the fact that glaciers did not reach that far south. And so it has had much more time to evolve differences in the species.
Is the population, and we're talking about something like 1,000 species, is the population under threat, though? We've been talking all about streams and water and pollution and things like that.
So 70% approximately of mussel species are imperiled, which is alarming, given that they are sort of the canary in the coal mine. They are indicators of the health of our system, mm-hmm. and something that we should heed as far as their disappearances.
Why are they imperiled, Sandra?
Well, all these reasons we've been talking about, that, you know, the rivers and creeks aren't as healthy, they don't have the flow, they don't have the habitat, and they, you know, and the pollution. So I think those are the key. You know, if you think about it, we've built dams on all these rivers and streams, so we've altered the flow. And one of the things we don't, I think, pay enough attention to is that it's not just how much water you have in a creek or a river or a stream, it's the timing of that flow. You know, all the life in rivers is has adapted over time to the pattern of flow. So they're used to a certain pattern of flow in the spring, in the mm-hmm. summer. And if we alter that, the habitats change and their life cycle cues change. And so You know, for all these reasons, and as Abby pointed out, what happens to the fish matters to the mussels. And so if we have changes in fish populations that are host to those mussels, that's going to affect the mussels. So it's that interconnectedness, that web of life interconnectedness that we really need to pay attention to.
So how do we rebuild the population, Abby?
I think one of the first steps is to pay attention to mussels, become aware.
Become a groupie like you?
Absolutely. Allow ourselves the sense of wonder to become aware of what their lives are and what they indicate, to become smarter about how we are managing water. And sometimes that can just mean, as Sandra pointed out, the timing of flows. There are situations like in Tennessee's Duck River, where they've done is work in collaborative partnerships to alter the timing of water release from the Normandy Reservoir, and they've improved life for these 60 mussel species in the river, as well as mitigating effects of droughts, like the 2007
sure.
drought.
Anything you want to add to that, Sandra?
I think that's exactly it. You know, mussels don't move very fast, and so if you dry up a creek and they're just going to fry in the sun. They can't move like a fish might move to a pool. So I think that's critical. It's just to manage water with mussels in mind and the rest of life that's interdependent.
Can we have mussel farms? I mean, kind of an aquaculture to rebuild the population? Abby?
So there are some very exciting places, for example, the Alabama Aquatic Biodiversity Center, where they are raising endangered species. I've had the opportunity to visit and hold in my hand some of the most endangered animals in the world. And some of these mussel species, there were very small populations, and now they have propagated them into the thousands. The trick is finding healthy, appropriate streams and rivers and into which to release them, but they are doing that with some success.
So I was reading this, something like 60% of all streams flow only after it rains or only seasonally. Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but is that a sign that some streams are drying up or that dams have sort of diverted water so that they don't flow in a kind of 24/7 timetable?
Let's see. Some streams are naturally that way. They're not perennial, so to speak, and so they will flow intermittently after a rain, or at a certain time of the year, and then not at others. But what we're seeing, and this is concerning, is that streams and rivers that should be perennial, they should flow all the time, are no longer flowing all the time because we've dammed them, diverted them, and there are thousands and thousands of miles of streams in the western United States that are in this category where they should be flowing and they're not flowing. And so that's a concern. And what's troublesome about that is, you know, as generations come along, they're accustomed to this river not flowing all the time. But in fact, naturally it should, you know. So I think part of, you know, what we're trying to do is bring that natural flow regime back through how we manage dams, how we conserve water, how we can put water back in at strategic times.
Let me read an email from Fred who says, discuss the drawdown of aquifers throughout the middle of the country. It poses a huge problem here and around the world, may be responsible for the revolution in Syria, something I think you were touching on before. We may have millions more of climate refugees if this drawdown continues, the drawdown of aquifers.
I agree. I appreciate the question. Thank you. I think the depletion of groundwater is one of the sleeping tigers of water. You know, it's literally out of sight, out of mind too often, and it's a critical part of our food security, it's a critical part of our drinking water security, but we're really not monitoring it, we're not regulating it, we're not paying enough attention to it. So the caller referred to, you know, the aquifers in the middle part of our country. Well, the Ogallala Aquifer, which spans parts of seven states from southern South Dakota all the way down to northwest Texas, is one of the biggest aquifers in the world. And we've been depleting, particularly the southern part of it, you know, northwest Texas, western Kansas. It's been drawing down for some time. Wells have been going dry, so land comes out of production. But it's I think of it as using tomorrow's water to meet our demands today. What's tomorrow going to do if that aquifer is depleted? And this is a global problem. If you look at, you know, when I've looked at our key food producing regions, China, India, Pakistan, the United States, you find groundwater depletion happening in a significant way in all of them. And so when you add it up, about 10% of our current food supply depends on the overpumping of groundwater, which is an unsustainable situation. And so it's, you can think of it as kind of a bubble in the food economy. You can't, and bubbles pop, as we
sure.
know, from housing bubbles to dot-com bubbles and everything else. They'll pop eventually. So we've got to prepare for this. And one of the projects we've been working with our partners in Change the Course is using some of that winter flood water in California to help replenish the groundwater below, for example, because the Central Valley of California is another area that's seen tremendous overpumping of groundwater, particularly during the recent drought. And so beginning to get that water back into those aquifers and using some of the flood water to do that. So there's a partnership between conservationists and scientists at UC Davis and elsewhere to work with farmers and irrigators to use some of their cropland during the dormant winter season to flood it and then recharge the aquifer below. But you have to be careful. I mean, some of this is on almond farms, for example. So you want to make sure it's not going to harm the roots of the almond tree. You're not going to have a decrease in yield. So there's a lot of science that has to go on before we can confidently scale this up. But it's a I think, a very promising road to take.
We're almost out of time here, Abby, but I did want to ask you about zebra mussels, quagga mussels. There are some mussels that seem to be in the more threatening category.
That's true. And those are non-native invasive species that have arrived here and done a very good job of wreaking havoc. Their life histories are different than our native freshwater mussels. They have a free-living larval stage, so they don't require a specific host. So they can reproduce like crazy.
Oh, wow.
And they are also sessile, so they stick to things. They stick to anything that holds still long enough, and they've caused lots of problems, clogging pipes. They've stuck to the native mussels themselves and killed them. So there has been a dramatic effect with those. Their peak harm we've reached it, at least in the Great Lake region, but they can continue to spread. So they also are filter feeders, though, and have done some improvements of water quality. So it's two sides to the coin.
I guess like most things. Mm-hmm. Sandra, I'm going to give you the last word. What then, for people listening to the show, I'm sure many of them are saying, okay, what can I do? What is the individual thing that an individual can do to ensure the supply, the quality of our water?
I think, one, know the source of your water, so connect to the source. And then every one of us can figure out ways we can shrink our personal water footprint. You know, you mentioned earlier in the show, 2,000 gallons a day to keep our lifestyle afloat if we're an average American. Well, half of that is our diet. A third of it is our energy use. And then the rest of it is, the clothes we buy, the computers we buy, and, of course, our water use at home, which is maybe 5 to 10%. So there's a lot we could do. Not wasting food is a great way to not waste water. Every time we make extra coffee and throw it down the drain, we're throwing 34 gallons of water per cup of coffee that we waste. So a really easy way to not waste water is to not waste food. And it doesn't change our quality of life at all. We just get more careful about not taking more than we can eat at the buffet line and things like that. So there's a lot we can do as an individual. I think getting involved in our communities with water and becoming an active member of a watershed community is a great way to get involved, too.
Well, Sandra Postel, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
I learned a lot. And she's director of the Global Water Policy Project. And she's speaking tonight at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University at 6:30. And that's here in Philadelphia. Abby, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty. You're wonderful.
It was great to have you here talking about mussels. And that's Abby Gosho-Landis. She's a veterinarian. And she's also the author of a new book called Immersion, The Science and Mystery of Freshwater Mussels. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.